reach of 60%, 60% weekly reach. A real lover of radio, but he does polarise opinions. I was nervous of some of the talent.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Paul Robinson.
I grew up in the home counties, spent most of my childhood in Camberley in Surrey. My father was literally a rocket scientist. He is a rocket scientist. He worked at what's called the Royal Aircraft Establishment in Farnborough. In those days, the British had a space program and launched rockets and had two big rockets, one called Black Knight and the other called Blue Streak. And these were launched from Woomera in Australia. And so he was travelling a lot. So I guess he was sort of imbibing me with maths and science. And so I started really liking physics and chemistry. I went to Camberley Grammar School, and then that became a comprehensive school. But I remember them saying, oh, you should do the Cambridge entrance exams, Oxbridge entrance exams. And they said, oh, you're in. I did my A-levels a year early. So I did my O-levels at 15, A-levels at 17. So I got into Cambridge. And then they said, oh, you can't come. You're too young. You can't come till 18. So I thought, oh, what do I do for a year? So, you know, I was a bit of a scientist. My dad was a scientist. So I went and worked for a research lab in Windlesham, in a lab which was testing crops for residues. So the good news was, in the summer, you got loads of free strawberries and raspberries and blackcurrants. So I used to bring all this fruit home to my mum, which was the stuff that hadn't had the pesticides on it, the control samples. And I remember I did that for a year and was paid the mighty sum of £986 annual salary, out of which, to my mother's disgust, I bought a motorbike. So I bought a motorbike, and so that gave me freedom, and I was then able to, you know, go wherever I like.
And now for Radio 1 and 2 listeners, it's over to the David Hamilton Show.
Thank you, Len. Good afternoon.
Well, I guess as a sort of a, you know, 10, 11, I started getting interested in pop music. Good afternoon. So I was listening to Radio 1 during the day and Radio Luxembourg at night. Very familiar. Luxembourg, I remember being so much more romantic, partly because it was fading in and out, but also these DJs I didn't really know. You know, people like Bob Stewart and Mark Wesley and Dave Christian, Tony Prince.
Hey now, this is Britain's longest serving, solid sounding, super duper smile station. The station that spots a successful sound soonest. And this is your royal ruler. I wouldn't fool you. Nothing.
I'm thinking this is all quite interesting and very sort of magical. I wasn't really very taken with Radio 1, and it was Tony Blackburn, David Hamilton, and so on, and it didn't really connect to me. I do remember, though, and we all did this at school, listening to the chart on Tuesdays when it came out with Johnny Walker at lunchtime, and recording it if I could, but definitely in a notebook writing down the chart positions. This was a religion, actually. We all did it. And I remember sitting in, you know, the common room and write down the chart.
Down one at three, I love you, love me, love, Gary Glitter. Up one at two, you won't find another fool like me from the New Seekers. And on 247 metres, you're tuned to Radio 1, the time 1 o'clock.
Radio 1, it's number one.
I didn't really sort of think I could ever work in this.
And no change at the top either. Into 1974, wishing Merry Christmas, this is Slade.
And it was really the start of commercial radio in the UK. And obviously I was in London, so the first stations were LBC and Capital in October 1973. And I do remember LBC starting, 8th of October. I was there on that first day and listened. Although it was a new station and it wasn't maybe what I wanted, it had a different sort of sound to it.
This is London Broadcasting, the news and information voice of independent radio.
Intimacy and a sort of a sense of not being, oh, we're talking to all you lot, and being a bit sort of remote. When Capital started, actually, it wasn't that good. It was very MOR music.
Merrily Rush and the Turnabouts with Angel of the Morning. Time for a break.
That is very strange show with Tommy Vance and Joan Shenton, which was really the sort of thing that Noel Edmonds did later, Swap Shop, where they had people on the phone talking on the air. Now, the BBC didn't do this at all at this point, and it sounds weird to say you didn't take phone calls on the air, but the BBC didn't. I mean, Jimmy Young used to read out all of his listener questions. But LBC was all phone-ins, and Capital had quite a lot of phone-ins.
This, for the very first time, is Capital Radio.
Capital launched in 1973, and then very quickly we went into the three-day week. In 1974, the country was in political turmoil. Everybody was on strike, you know, the coal miners were out, the train drivers were out.
As Prime Minister, I want to speak to you about the grave emergency now facing our country.
The country was in a complete mess. I was given petrol coupons. We actually had petrol coupons issued. And so there's these radio stations, and this, obviously commercial radio is starting to launch in other cities too, and the country was in a complete mess. So there was no advertising. And so Richard Attenborough, who's the chairman, allowed some of his paintings to be sold off stroke, money lent against them, just to pay the bills at Capital, because they didn't have any money.
I didn't actually sell them. I put them in the boot of the car, and I took them down to the Bank of Scotland, and we went in to plead for an upgrading of our overdraft.
And they fired their newsroom. They had no news. The only news they took at that point was IRN, so there was no local news whatever. They extended all the shows. They'd also got the format completely wrong. I mean, it was a horrible mess. So I carried on listening to this and thinking it was really interesting. And then Capital really improved. They changed the schedule and they massively rocked up the music. I came to love that station. You know, that lineup that I can remember, the one that sort of sticks with me the most was when Graham Dean came from Radio City in 1975 and went on The Breakfast Show, replacing Kenny Everett.
25 minutes now to 8.
And you had Michael Aspel in the morning, 9 till 12, Dave Cash at lunchtime, Roger Scott, London Tonight, Adrian Loves Open Line, Nicky Horn, Tony Meyer, and then Mike Allen, Peter Young overnight. I listened to that station all day. I listened to it 24 hours a day. I just absolutely thought, this is the most amazing thing. I'd love to do this. Although I never at that point thought I could actually do it, because it seemed so remote. But suddenly I was in Camberley and it seemed to bring the glamour of London to me. I couldn't get to London that much, but I felt like it was bringing me all the excitement and all the energy of London. Also, unlike Radio 1, playing me music I hadn't heard before, turning me onto stuff I hadn't heard. I've got a big record collection. I was always buying records. I had been from a young age. What happened now was I started buying records because these DJs played these records. And you started to build this relationship, which was one of trust. And then one day, I think it was about the end of 75, 76, I was listening to Graham Dean, and he said, Radio St Stephen's is a new hospital radio station. They're going to start a St Stephen's Hospital in the Fulham Road, now the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, but then it was called St Stephen's Hospital. And we want people to come along and volunteer and help start this hospital radio station. And there was a meeting being held at the hospital, you know, one evening. So I popped along and I sort of sat at the back and took notes. And they were looking for people to go on the air, but also to raise money. For about a year, we did, you know, three-legged walks. You know, I even tried making cakes. That was a disaster. And we've been allocated a space in the basement of the hospital where the heating pipes went through. So it really was like going into a sauna. I mean, you literally had to go in there and take your clothes off because it was so bloody hot. But, you know, you're 18, 19, you don't care. Then I sort of said, oh, could I do a little program? And they said, oh, there's a space on the sports show. So there was this guy called Jack Fox, I remember, who was an insurance guy who was a Fulham fan. He was sort of like a genial uncle to me, and I was sort of his assistant. And so we worked together and had quite a nice little partnership. Within about 6 months, the station manager said, oh, you're actually not bad. Would you like to do your own show? So I ended up doing this request show. And that was really my start in radio, via hospital radio, having done all these jumble sales. So I went to Cambridge. There was no university radio station at Cambridge. There was a great debating society, and I joined that, and that was fantastic and really helped you to stand on your own two feet in front of an articulate and intelligent crowd and argue your case. I value that because I think those communication skills are valuable in whatever you do, radio management, whatever it is. But it meant I had to keep going back down to London every weekend to do my show. So I was commuting every weekend. I think I spent most of my student grant on train fares. But I didn't care because I wanted to do this show come what may. And I did. I didn't miss a week. So after university, I went to work for an industrial gas company. And they were a very aggressive company, headquartered in New Malden. And I thought, oh, great, I can be in New Malden and I can, you know, live in London. But no, they sent me to Sunderland.
Driving down the A1. Or sitting in your easy chair.
So here I am, Southern boy, sent to Sunderland in the depths of winter. And this is 1978, which was a bloody cold winter. I remember I bought a little brown Ford Escort. I'm driving up the A1 and it's getting colder and colder. And then there's the snow parked either side of the road. And I'm thinking, this is just, I can't believe this. So going to the northeast for the first time was quite a shock. When you spend your day with 261. And I had a little flat at Roker, just behind Roker Park, which was then Sunderland's ground. And I thought, well, I probably need to find another hospital radio station because I can't commute from Sunderland to London. This is just too much. This is going to completely kill me. And so I found this station called Radio Tyneside. And so I wrote to the station manager and he said, come for an audition. And I remember it was at the RVI in Newcastle. This is a guy called Dave Nicholson. He had about 12 people being interviewed for this. And I remember it was quite formal. I had to read a piece of news. I had to play a couple of records. Anyway, Dave rang me up and said, ha, ha, ha. He said, the 11 rejected. You're the guy we wanted. Come back and come and talk to us. And so I started at Radio Tyneside doing two shows. I mean, ridiculously, a rock show and a talk music show. And Radio Tyneside, by the way, is a great radio station. I mean, as a hospital radio station, I learned so much there. They are as good as any local radio station. They really look after their people and run with a rod of iron, I would say, but actually rightly so. I mean, it's a very, very good radio station with an amazing range of shows. But anyway, Dave said, you should try getting into Metro. So I sent a tape off to Metro to a guy called Mick Johnson, who was the then program director. I remember having an interview with Mick. Mick had sort of a haircut like a sort of pudding basin, but he didn't ever give you any eye contact. So I sat there having this interview with Mick, and he's looking out the window, and I'm looking at him, but he's not looking at me. And also, Metro in those days was in a place called Swarwell, opposite a coal mine. And so you look out the window, and there's just a pile of shit outside. I remember driving into the car park, and I had nicely clean shoes. They weren't clean when I walked in the building, because the car park was just full of mud. I mean, it was the most unglamorous place. You know, and I've been listening to, you know, Capital and LBC and thinking, oh, this is amazing, so glamorous. Get to Metro. And it really wasn't the same. And they had these awful old sort of metal windows that creaked. Some sort of rather poor hospital. Anyway, meeting with Mick Johnson, he said, we'll give you a tryout on this thing called Hot and Heavy Express. Saturday nights, 10 p.m. till 2 a.m, basically for all the pissed up Geordies. It was Metallica and Motorhead and Hawkwind and Deep Purple. And then they did a couple of overnights. And then I had a letter from Metro and they said, thank you very much, but we feel your presentation is too glossy for Metro. We won't be taking it any further. And in a way, I was quite glad because Metro's music policy in those days was absolutely dire. It seemed like it was all Nolan's records to me, listening to it.
This is Giles Squire.
Giles Squire was on in the evening. He was the guy I listened to, and Giles did a really good show in the evening. But during the day, Bill Steele. Now, Bill, I listened to Bill, and I couldn't understand why I kept hearing clicking on the air. Later on in life, I used to really try and pride myself on not exposing the clicks on air. And I started to be sensitive to this. Now, with Bill, he kept hearing all this clicking on the air, and I couldn't understand what it was. And then I actually got a chance to go in the studio and see him one day. And I realised he had no feel for the music, because he wasn't really a music person. So when he started playing a record, he'd click his stopwatch, and then he'd look at his stopwatch, do his link, and he'd hit the vocal perfectly, but it was all because it was on a stopwatch. I couldn't listen to Bill after that, because all I could see was this vision of him with his stopwatch. And they had people like Paddy McDee, who's a lovely guy, and others on there. So that was Metro. I thought, oh, well, that's radio career over. Now, unbeknown to me, what Dave did is he sent the same demo to Radio Tees in Stockton. I didn't really have Radio Tees on my radar at all. The programme director then was Dave Cousins of the Straubs, who wrote most of the fantastic Straubs songs. Now I don't mean to be a stick in the dirt, the world is changing on the reverse. I think back now, he was an amazing character. Anyway, sent it off to Radio Tees. I didn't know about this. 4 days later, we get a phone call from Radio Tees saying, would you come for an interview? Drove down to Radio Tees, and they said, can you do overnights next week? Just amazing. I mean, I couldn't believe my luck. So I did Dawn Flight, as it were called, Sunday night, as my first show. Somebody joined the same time, this guy called John Simons. He and I joined at the same time. And so basically, John and I ended up doing the overnights for Radio Tees between us. But Dave was the programme director, and Dave carried on doing his gigs. And he'd often turn up for work in his stage gear. And he was a total showman. I mean, he was obviously also, I guess, on a learning curve about radio. And if you're listening, Dave, I hope you don't mind me saying that. You were a great boss. You loved your music. I do remember you having issues with some of the stuff that I played. And I do remember also playing stuff because I know you liked it, because I wanted my contract renewed. So from overnights, within 3 weeks of doing overnights, they said, can you dep on the evening show? This was 4 hours of music you choose yourself. And it had to be sort of melodic, soft, rock, easy listening. And then 2 weeks after that, the guy who was doing the drive time show, a guy called Brian Anderson, who went off to Murray Firth Radio, resigned. And they said, would you do drive time? The show had the lovely title of Afternoon High. So within 6 weeks or so, they gave me drive time. I was also working in the features department. We used to have a lot of speech on Radio Tees, and the features department produced all these speech items, and it would be theatre reviews and book reviews and local events and so on. Really good speech that was put onto reel-to-reel tapes and played out in the shows according to a schedule. I was asked to do an arts programme. They gave me the top 40. So I was doing about 9 shows a week. Oh, and I did Saturday breakfast at some time as well. Anyway, from doing nothing, suddenly I was on the air about 30 hours a week. It was ludicrous, but amazing. And, gosh, I learnt very fast.
Now, thank you very much to Irene Coltman's husband, who came in yesterday with a card and also a little lavender bag in the shape of a T-shirt with my name on the front and 257 on the back. A nice little souvenir. Thank you for that.
Radio Tees was in Dovecot Street, in what was the old Waterworks building, just off Dovecot High Street. I remember Albert on reception. I mean, Albert's the first thing to say. Albert was the overnight security guard. And everyone's fearful of Albert because Albert actually had this book. And if there was a complaint about you, he'd write it in the book. And then he'd photocopy the book and leave it on the programme director and managing director's desk. So you had to influence Albert to make sure he wrote nice things about you. So I do remember making Albert cups of tea. And basically anything Albert wanted, Albert got. And Albert knew this. And he was sort of sat there, you know, he looked a bit like Les Dawson. And then the studios were on the ground floor. So as you walked in reception, there was a glass window, slightly tinted glass. Then the sales office on the ground floor. And then on the stairs above, there was the presenter's office, the newsroom, and the managing director's office. The managing director was a guy called Toby Horton, who was a lovely man, but he didn't really want to be in radio. He wanted to be a Tory MP. Dave was the programme controller. A guy called Donald Klein, who was from the US, who was head of commercial production, who was one of the most talented radio guys I've ever met. Our ads on Radio T sounded brilliant, at times better than the programmes. And he eventually became the programme director. And there was a guy called Russ Stewart, who's our sales director. Mark Page was doing the breakfast show. And Mark was, you know, a local superstar. And Mark did rule the roost. I mean, Mark was the top guy. We were all very secondary to Mark. You know, Mark got all the gigs. Mark was the guy. He had a car with his name on it.
Well, listening to me, Mark, on the breakfast show every morning, 5 till 9, over the coming weeks. The news of Dennis, the first astronaut from Middlesbrough.
And then Nick Meanwell, and then a guy called Jim Gibbons doing mornings, Kevin Keatings. What was it like? It was like a little family, really. I mean, I guess I was aware I'd come in as a very junior person into this family. It was wonderful in the sense it was very relaxed. I mean, we chose all our music. We had a playlist which was singles in a box. You in theory, you had to take the first one in the box and put the one you've just played to the back of the box. Couldn't say I never avoided the one I really hated and put it back to the back of the box, but of course we all did that. But that was the rotation system for the playlist. And you had to play, I think, 6 playlist records an hour. And aside from that, you chose everything. You know, you're choosing all the music. I booked all the guests, booked all the features, booked all the phone-in guests. Radio Tees was different to other ILR stations in one way, and that is it wasn't self-op. We had an MCR with an engineer on the other side of the glass. And the reason for that was the chief engineer was a guy called Chaz Kennedy, who'd come from Capital. And that was how Capital was set up. So when you're on overnights, you're doing it all yourself. When you get into daytime, suddenly you've got a guy playing the ads, a guy playing in all the news cuts. That was a real luxury. Eventually, after drive time, I got mornings. And I did mornings for a long, long stretch, 9 till 12, morning call. And the last hour, 11 till 12, was a phone-in without any music. And so obviously when you've got someone playing in the ads, that really helps when you've got guests and you've got calls coming in. On one occasion, I swore on the air. The reason was we had these cart stacks, you know, with the Sonifex cart stacks. We used to always have an advert backed up to the news jingle. And I remember playing the news jingle at the wrong time in the middle of the ad break. So I was opening the microphone to do the link into the news and said, oh, shit. And I thought, oh, my God. I did get a bollocking for it. My forfeit actually was, they said, we're not going to fire you, but you are going to have a forfeit. and you're going to have to do something for free just to learn your lesson. And they made me present the classical music program for free. 257 Radio T. We certainly did not have sessions at all going through our radar, well, as it was in those Jikroff figures. I didn't even know when the Jikroff figures were coming out. We got good feedback from the management, but it was more about just generally how you're doing. I was aware that people were coming and going, and we said, oh, he's gone because his numbers weren't very good. They did share with us the overall numbers. We did know, Radio T's had a very good audience. We had a reach of 50, 51% in the time I was there, and about 12, 13 hours per listener. So they did share us those numbers. We also were aware that it wasn't doing commercially that well. Not that we were told officially, but I mean, I befriended some of the PAs, and particularly the MD's PA. Well, actually, a lovely lady called Nora Barber. Nora was just, she was like the mother hen that kept us all together. But Nora would sometimes be slightly indiscreet and would tell you things. And I think it was break even or sometimes under or just over quite a lot at Radio T's for a long time. I mean, there was no budget for anything. I mean, we were paid, I remember we were paid £25 a show. Didn't matter what show you did. There was no budget for guests. There was no budget for expenses. There was no budget for anything. If I went out and did an interview with my ewer, there was no budget for that either. I'd have to use my own car. There was no petrol money. But we knew we weren't making loads of money. We knew Metro in Newcastle was doing much better than we were.
Thank you, Kim. It's 6:30 past nine, Wednesday morning. Good morning. This is Paul Robinson on Morning Call.
I was at Radio T's and having a fantastic time. And I remember I'd been approached by Ian Rufus, who was the then programme controller at Mercia Sound. I went to Coventry for an interview with him, and it was to be interviewed for the evening show. And I didn't get it. And so I forgot all about Mercia Sound. And then about a year later, I had a phone call from Ian Rufus, and he was in his car at Wetherby, which was just on the southern fringes of the Radio T's area. In those days, there was no radio air. And so, in fact, you could get Radio T's well into Leeds. And so they were in Wetherby and listening to my show in their car, parked in a lay-by somewhere, or a little chef, you know, having a cup of tea. And Ian said, we're listening to you and we quite like what we hear. Would you like to come and meet us again in Coventry? I said, I can, but I'm going to a wedding. So he said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you go to the wedding and then come to my house and we'll have a barbecue in the garden and we can talk then. So I remember going to this wedding and then driving to Ian Rufus's house and having a lovely time, beers and stuff, and trying not to drink too much. And then he said, oh, this is Stuart. So he said, this is Stuart Linnell. You need to meet Stuart Linnell. Because by this point, Ian had become the managing director of Mercia Sound and Stuart was the programme director. And they said, we'd like to do the breakfast show. John Warwick is leaving. I didn't have to think about it for very long, but I didn't give them an answer there and then because I'd been aware that while I was doing mornings, the real peak show was breakfast. I mean, breakfast is the show you all want to be on. If you're a DJ, you want to be doing the breakfast show. That's the peak show. So I went to see Mercia Sound, and it was a bit like going to a modern version of Radio T's, because you walk in the door, and there's the studio behind the glass window, and the setup was identical, except this time it was in an old nightclub, as opposed to being in a waterworks. The sort of defining feature of Mercia Sound was they'd left the silver glitter ball in the building. So I rang them back and said, yeah, I'd love to. That'd be great. Thank you very much. When do I start? Now, this was a risk, of course, because at the time, Mercia had the highest reach of any station in England. We had a reach of 60%, 60% weekly reach, which is unheard of now. I mean, ridiculous. So I did take it on thinking, if I screw this up, I'm not going to last very long. But I thought, well, I've done this for 4 years now on Radio T's. I think I can probably cut it. I couldn't actually get to find a way to live in Coventry. I'd got married by this point. We had a dog. We had to find a home for the dog. And I just happened to have this conversation, long story short, with this lady who lived in Leamington Spa, had a dog kennel. So we put the dog in the dog kennel. Rest of family stayed in the north for the moment. And so the lady around the dog kennel said, you can stay at the dog kennel if you'd like, and you can come and live here while you're finding somewhere to live. So I didn't live in the dog kennel, but I lived at the dog kennel. The big problem was in the morning, I was on at 6, so I had to drive from Leamington. So I had to leave there about 4:30, was trying to drive out without getting all the dogs barking because, you know, I was trying to tip-tap around, get out of the place. And of course, all the bloody dogs start barking. So the whole house is woken up. So went to Mercia, and Mercia was commercially successful. And Ian Rufus, who ran it, was probably one of the best managers I've ever worked for. Very benevolent in the sense that he was very supportive, you know, gave you real coaching, but ran that radio station superbly. I mean, it was very efficient. It really knew how to be a rocking top 40 station, but be local. Everything you did was local. And I remember being tested on pronunciation of local place names, getting Charlesmoor right and Steitchel right, and wanting me to drive around the area and learn the patch. And I thought, gosh, this attention to detail is really impressive. I think Mercia was probably one of the best examples of how to run a local radio station, be upbeat with it, have lots of content, lots of music, lots of speech, but be absolutely rooted in the patch. If you lived in the area, Mercia was the station that was relevant to you. It wasn't Radio 1, it wasn't Radio 2, it was us. The local news was also amazing. I mean, we had about 11 journalists, I think. And Stuart ran the sport, and obviously Coventry in those days were a more successful team than they are now, but Stuart Linnell ran the sports show, and he did an amazing, I mean, one of the best local radio sports shows, I think, ever.
That's the lineup that puts Mercia Sports Beat at the top of the league for your Saturday afternoon listening.
Mercia was a really, really great commercial radio station, and I think that model is a model that would work today, but it absolutely worked then. And of course, took advantage of the fact that it wasn't from Birmingham. I also did a column for The Citizen, the Coventry Evening Telegraph, a music column. So I wrote this weekly column for them called, very, very imaginative title, it's called Paul on Pop. And it used to come out on Thursdays, but I had to deliver it at 10 a.m. on the Monday. So I remember my routine on Monday was finish on air at 9, cup of coffee, walk round to the Coventry Evening Telegraph, which was opposite the Belgrave Theatre, hand over my copy, and then that would appear on Thursdays. I mean, sounds incredibly archaic. I mean, there was no email. So I was doing this, and then lots of gigs. I had two or three residencies. I remember doing this place called the Bug and Black Bat. I mean, I was very privileged in that I'd come on at midnight or something and do an hour. So this poor DJ is on from 8 till 3 or something, and I come on and do 1 hour. And, you know, I'm paid 150 quid and he's getting probably 20 quid for the whole night. But I did learn a very valuable lesson, and that was to make sure that he didn't play all the good records before I came on. So I used to always slip him a fiver or a tenner to make sure that he saved some of the good records for me, because I knew and I learned very quickly that if I came on and the dance floor cleared, I'm meant to be the name presenter. And, you know, you come on and the dance floor clears, you won't get booked next week. So, yeah, so I'm at Mercia, and I'm now sort of becoming mid to late 20s and thinking, well, maybe I ought to start thinking about management here. Maybe you're aware that as a presenter, you're vulnerable. Should I maybe go and do something in management? And I was looking in a broadcast magazine, a trade magazine, and there was an advert for an assistant programme director at Chiltern Radio. And I secretly wanted to work for Capital or LBC or maybe Radio 1, but really Capital or LBC. And so I thought, well, Chiltern's further south, so that's good. I'm getting a bit closer to London. So I applied and had the interview with the MD, Colin Mason. I mean, Colin's a great character, a real lover of radio, but he does polarise opinions. Colin was, he's a Territorial Army guy. He's a Lieutenant Colonel. Colin ran Chiltern like it was a military operation. And Colin was always immaculately dressed. He had a beautiful suit on, tie, you know, coiffured. And actually, he and I got on really well. But the interview was very strange because it was very, very formal. And I didn't think I'd got it. But I had a call back from Cheryl, his PA, and said, we'd like you to start. So I gave my notice at Mercia and went down to Dunstable. Chiltern was headquartered in Dunstable. I knew there were some interesting challenges there because Chiltern was, you know, one of these twinned stations. Devonair was one and Chiltern was another one. And we had to have studios in Luton and in Bedford. And Chiltern had just acquired the Northampton licence. Hereward Radio, the Peterborough franchise, had Northampton.
You're listening to Hereward Radio, broadcasting on 1557 kilohertz, that's 193 metres in the medium wave band, serving Northamptonshire and Milton Keynes.
It was really draining them of cash. Peterborough, they decided to surrender it. Colin acquired it for Chiltern, so added Northampton. But it was doing terribly. I mean, it had really bad figures. It had a reach of about 16, 17%. And there were literally no adverts at all. And Chiltern had just taken this over. And I thought, well, maybe there's an opportunity here. And the programme director was a guy called Phil Fothergill, who'd been there a long time, very experienced guy. Phil had done a great job, but the station wasn't really a local radio station. It was a bit disorganised, if I'm honest. They had a playlist and a music policy, but none of the DJs seemed to stick to it. had some great talent on the air, people like Martin Collins, Paul McKenna, but they were all doing their own thing. And there was hardly any localness at all. They had a box of What's Ons, but people didn't really read them. And I looked in the studio and most of them were out of date. And they'd added on Northampton. Suddenly, people in Northampton are getting traffic reports about the M25 or what's happening in Watford. And I thought, from what I know about Mercia, this isn't going to work. And so I came up with the proposal to create local programming in each of the markets and add much more local programming because everything was networked. Colin basically liked it, and it was a bit of a tough time in a way because he let Phil go and said, you're now the program director. And that happened within about 6 weeks. So very difficult for Phil, and I felt awful about that. And I was much, much younger than Phil. I think I was about 29 at this point, so quite young to run this radio station. I do feel a bit guilty because Phil, you know, left Chilton, having been at Chilton a long time. Colin did the right thing, but I feel a bit guilty about him being displaced, but it wasn't my fault. But I'd apologise to Phil for that because he built a good foundation. I introduced local programming 8 hours a day in Dunstable, Bedford and Northampton.
That's going to be great. Looking forward to that. Yes, yes. 23 minutes to nine with Phil and Dot. Here come the Everleys on the Hard One. Don't
want your love. Hired some people whose names are probably familiar. People like Paul Fear, who did The Breakfast Show in Dunstable. Chris Tarrant was on Capital at the time, and Capital came right into the Chilton area. And Capital, actually, in the southern part of our area, had a better reach than we had in our own area. So I thought, well, what we'll do is we can't compete with Tarrant, but let's put someone on who's going to sound very, very solid, great voice, complete antidote to Tarrant, make it local, great music, tight, minimal links. So we separated the stations, then had drive time with Martin Collins in the afternoon shared. But I made all the links split, and not surprisingly, within 6 months, we'd added 2 or 3 percentage points in our reach, and we added about 10 percentage points over a period of 2 years, and the hours went from single figures into double figures. So we almost trebled the total listening hours just by being local.
One big hit after another.
And there was this guy there who was clearly a star for the future, a name everyone will know, called Clive Dickens, who was still at school. This is in the days of the network chart with David Kidd Jensen, 5 till 7 on Sundays. And so someone had to sit in the studio in case the line went down. Because in those days, the network chart was using the IRN contribution circuit. So it was in mono, coming up the IRN contribution circuit. It's not a very robust delivery mechanism. So someone had to sit in the studio in case the line went down.
Right across the UK, from Swansea Sound to Aberdeen's North Sound, and from Liverpool's Radio City to Portsmouth's Radio Victory, this is the Network Top 30 with David Jensen. And here's the
So Clive was sitting in the studio, and he was also doing a bit of karting. So he was karting adverts up for the sales department. And he was clearly a star, and he rightly sort of badgered me for more work. And actually, I made Clive then head of music later on. Clive was a fountain of promotional ideas, and he ran all of the sort of the on-air in terms of competitions and stuff, and did a great job. Chilton just didn't look back from that point. 96.9
Chiltern Radio, 97.6.
I was learning how to manage people. I do remember one big challenge presented to me fairly early on. That was one of the presenters, quite a big name, came to me and I think maybe saw the opportunity and said, I want a pay rise. And he was on whatever he was on. And he wanted an increase, which was a 30%, 40% increase. And he said, unless I get the pay rise, I'm leaving. I talked to Colin about it, and you know, I think, God, I can't lose this person. He's, you know, he's critical to the station. He's been here with us years. Everybody knows him. Maybe we've got to pay this. And Colin said, no, you mustn't. Offer him something, but don't offer him that much. You know, offer him something reasonable. You've got to accept. If he doesn't accept, he goes. So I had the meeting with the guy and I said, look, we really love you. You know, love what you do, but we can't pay you that. But I am willing to make an offer, and my offer is this. Following day, he came back and said, I'm not accepting it. So I said, well, in which case, really sorry, but you've just done your last show. You know, I had to do it. I had to demonstrate some toughness. But I mean, I was quaking in my boots thinking, shit, what's going to happen now? A, who am I going to put on there tomorrow? And what's going to happen to the audience? So that was a big test. I was in charge of news as well, and I'd never run a newsroom. Chilton had a big newsroom. We had 4 people, I think, in every centre. And then the news editor quit, which actually was quite helpful because that meant I could hire my own news editor. And the person I hired was a guy called Paul Chandler, you know, Paul and I became great buddies. So with Clive, Paul and I, we had a really good team. Together, we built Children into a much more powerful station. It was really underperforming. You know, one of the results of that was actually that we lost a lot of our jocks to Capital. Richard Park used to call me regularly and say, Paul, I want to take one of your team. And he stole nearly all my jocks at one point, I think.
I don't know, you know, maybe you could doze for a little longer. Go in late today and tell the boss, say, Paul McKenna at the Hot FM said it was all right.
There was the startings in the industry now of consolidation. Colin's big rival at this time, the guy who used to always come up in our management meetings, was a guy called Ralph Bernard. And Ralph is probably the master in terms of acquiring stations, putting them together and building them and doing a great job with them. And Ralph was building his empire in the Southwest and in the Midlands. Colin was terrified of being hemmed in by Ralph. By this point, Ralph had got Hereward Radio, which was close to us. And so Colin was convinced he had to acquire as well. So the first acquisition was actually Severn Sound in Gloucestershire. And then the Bristol opportunity came up, and there was a station in Bristol called For the People Radio.
These transmissions are in preparation for the new independent local radio service for the Bristol area, which will be provided by FTP.
And it had an appallingly low audience, making no money, doing a lot of, I'm sure, well-intentioned community programmes, but ultimately they hadn't focused on the things that really matter. And so we acquired FTP. But we had to find a format that would work in Bristol because GWR had GWR FM. Before we got to Bristol, we'd actually won the Milton Keynes licence. When Milton Keynes came up, Colin was furious because Milton Keynes was wholly enclosed within the Chiltern Patch. And Milton Keynes was a very, very rich source of advertising, much richer than Luton or Dunstable. We had to win the Milton Keynes licence. So we put a huge amount of resource into winning that licence. Fortunately, we won it. But we had to again find a different music format for Milton Keynes because we couldn't copy the Chiltern format because the two were entirely overlapped. So we put the dance format in, which worked very well in Milton Keynes because Milton Keynes is a very young city. So we had this dance format in Milton Keynes. So we thought, well, let's put that into Bristol. So actually what we did is we used to photocopy the selector logs, selector being the software system you use to create your music format, photocopy the Horizon Radio Milton Keynes logs and send them down to Bristol, and they'd play the same music in Bristol. The challenge was the name, actually. Colin wanted to call it Crystal FM, and Paul Clive and I were absolutely against Crystal FM. We didn't think that gave the right sound. And I'm not quite sure where Galaxy came from. I do remember endless board meetings where we were discussing the name. The important matters of the day used to get nodded through very quickly in the board meeting, but the name no one could agree on. And we replaced FTP with Galaxy, and that was the start of the network that Phil Riley and all the other guys then took on and built very successfully around the country. But that was the origins of Galaxy in Bristol on 97.4. I do remember going to see the station, and we had this car park which was fenced with a big lock and barbed wire at the top. And I said, why is the car park fenced? It was in the St Paul's area of Bristol. And they said, well, if you don't put your car in there, you won't find the wheels there when you come off and finish your shift. Bristol's favourite station, Galaxy Radio. When I was at Chiltern, I was based in Dunstable, and so able for the first time to get to London regularly. Chiltern became quite a hot little station for the record companies. So all the pluggers, and they wanted us to play their records. Now, this hadn't really happened very much at Radio Tees or Mercia Sound. Radio Tees, you'd see plugger maybe once a quarter, if you're lucky, or ever, if ever. And also at this time, really got involved with the Radio Academy. Now, I joined the Radio Academy in 1985 at Mercia. It was always difficult to get to events, but now I was able to get involved. So I joined some of the Radio Academy committees, and I met Johnny Beerling, who was then the controller of Radio 1. Johnny and I were both on what was then the Radio Festival Planning Committee. So obviously we've stuck a bit of a friendship up. Johnny rang me up and said, would you like to come and meet me in the pub and have a chat? And so I remember going to this pub in Docklands, just at the end of Marsh Wall, because it had sort of a very pale pink pebble dash on the outside. And he said that we have an opportunity. Roger Lewis is leaving. And he said, you need to meet Chris Lysett. So I had the meeting, and they offered me the job. I hadn't filled out an application form. And I remember BBC personnel ringing me from Yalding House saying, who are you? We haven't got your phone number or your address, and I understand you're joining the BBC, but we don't know who you are. And can you fill out the application form, please? So I'd already been offered the job, but hadn't filled out any paperwork at all. But that was Johnny. Johnny made Radio 1 very successful because that's how he ran it. He ran it almost independently of the BBC. You know, he was successful despite the BBC, and that was part of the success of Radio 1. So I was offered this job to basically run all of the daytime and then weekends, and then Stuart Grundy did the evenings and did the specialist shows, and also run the playlist. I mean, this was an amazing, an extraordinary bit of luck, really. And I think it was just because I was in the right place at the right time. Johnny wanted someone who could bring a bit more commercial radio approach to Radio 1. Radio 1 was a little bit antiquated. When I got to Radio 1, the way the shows were constructed was incredibly archaic. There was no computer system of any sort. And the way the daily running orders were put together was via pieces of paper cut into strips. That would then be put onto a sort of little washboard frame, and all these bits of paper juggled together, and that would be the running order. There was no connection at all between shows. The lineup when I joined Radio 1 was Simon Mayo doing the breakfast show, Simon Bates doing mid-mornings, Gary Davis doing lunchtime, Steve Wright in the afternoon, Mark Goodyear, evening session, John Peel. That was the weekday lineup.
Hot House Flowers and Don't Go. We're going to be bashing out the music on 1FM.
And there was one day, in fact, when I remember listening to Gary Davis, who played his last record. He was on from 12:45 to 3, and he played his last record, whatever it was, Culture Club, 5 to 3. And the Radio 1 studios worked on the basis of A and B studios, so they'd alternate between studios. So DJs didn't hot seat, you know, as we did in commercial radio. So they never really talked to each other. And Steve and Gary didn't really have much of a relationship, let's put it that way. And so Gary does his goodbyes, jingle, Radio 1 FM, and then Steve Wright starts, plays the identical record. So that made me realise at that point something had to be done about this. And I say that in the context, at the point I joined Radio 1, Radio 1 had 19 million listeners a week, weekly reach. So hugely dominant, hugely successful. That said, in London we were not. Radio 1 was not that good in London. Radio 1 was down to about fourth in London. Capital was number one, Radio 4 was second, and Radio 1 was a very bad performer. To be fair, Radio 1 was only on medium wave. But it was culturally a big change because suddenly you've got many, many more people. There's lots of egos, massive egos, and not just the presenters. And you're part of the BBC, and you've got to go to BBC meetings. David Hatch, who was then the managing director of radio, wonderful man, old school, former controller Radio 2, former controller Radio 4, amazing stand-up. David would do meetings, and it was just a gag after gag after gag. He was just the most incredible speaker. Old school sort of BBC guy, you know, tweed jacket with sort of, you know, elbows and you know, tie. But a brilliant radio man. And I remember getting a note from him saying, "Dear Paul, you know, one of our new members of the management team, we need to invite you to Cabinet. And this is the top 30 senior people in network radio. Come to Cabinet at my office at this time. Please come." So I thought, oh, this is good. I'm now going to be mixing, you know. So I turned up with my notebook and you know, already. And he walks in, he says, "What's that for?" And I said, "Well, to make notes." He says, "No, you idiot." He said, "This is drinks cabinet." It was where he got his Twiglets out. And you'd have a glass of warm Chardonnay. Basically, the senior managers chewing the fat and just discussing what was going on. David had this habit of writing notes to people. He used to get these hero notes from David, and he had a fountain pen. And he had these little cards printed with, "From David Hatch, MDNR, Managing Director, Network Radio." And if you did a good programme, you know, whether you're a producer on Radio 4 or someone on Radio 3, he'd write you a note and say, you know, "Listen to this, blah, blah, blah." And David used to do so much listening. I mean, he was brilliant. He listened to the whole network, all the networks. And occasionally you'd get these little notes come through, you know, put into your pigeonhole. And David's listened and he's made a comment. And I thought that was great management by him. And I put it in context. There was no email in those days. So, you know, when I had to do a note to all my team, I'd write a memo. My PA would type the memo. I would sign it. She'd photocopy it 40 times and it would go into the pigeonholes. And that's how we communicated. I mean, ridiculous and archaic, but that's how it worked.
Right, well, it's Thursday, 30th of August. Yes, it is. And before 8 o'clock, someone's very
excited. I was nervous of some of the talent. And I do remember some of the talent was lovely. I mean, Alan Freeman, you know, he comes up to you, gives you a snog, and he just, you know, just fantastic. Tommy Vance, you know, doing the Friday Rock Show. Bruno Brooks, you know, lovely. Simon Mayo, really nice too. Gary Davis, lovely guy, lovely, lovely guy. Gary would do anything for you. But there were two who were more challenging, and that was Simon Bates and Steve Wright. Both brilliant broadcasters. but they took some management. And I realized that my training in commercial radio probably needed to go up a notch. Simon used to do this thing called the Golden Hour from 9 till 10 every morning, which basically was Simon on the phone or talking to management. I mean, he had this amazing ability to do the show brilliantly, but most of the time he was actually doing something else.
Veteran Labour PM Manny Shinwell was 100 years old, and this year Princess Diana went home 22 hours after having her...
It was when I used to go and talk to Simon, and Simon would say, come into the studio, love, and we'll chat about it. And I'd go in the studio while the Golden Hour was on, and I'm thinking, this show's going out to 6 or 7 million people, and he's talking to me, and we're having a meeting, and he's doing the show brilliantly. Did I get everything I wanted? No, of course not. Did I get a lot of what I wanted? Yes, I did. And I think I did it by trying to build a relationship with them. You know, what you could not do was direct them. You know, you had to persuade them. You had to get them on board, spend time with them. I used to go to gigs with Simon and with Fergus, his producer, Fergus Dudley, who's still at Radio 2. Simon took me to this very odd gay club and we saw Take That. And I went because I wanted to spend the time with Simon. With Steve, Steve asked me to do voices for his afternoon show. He used to record all the stuff in the morning. So I used to do some voices for Steve. And that was a way of working with Steve. You know, I became, you know, sort of a little part of his posse, doing bits on the air. And there were other people who were difficult. I mean, I don't really want to mention names, but there was another presenter at the weekends who was very, very difficult indeed. He had what we called the sad bag. He would bring in his own records, which were completely inappropriate for Radio 1. Very hard to give him feedback that they were inappropriate for the target audience. But he'd been there a long time and believed he knew better than me. In fact, he told me that. He said, look, I've been doing this since you were in short trousers. You know, you're not telling me what to do. So that was difficult. But most of them were lovely. And I look back now and I think, what a privilege to have worked with that that talent. Johnny left as controller, and he was sort of, I think he was sort of asked to leave by the change in management. So David Hatch left. John Burt was now DG, Director General. He brought in Liz Forgan from Channel 4 to be the new MDNR. Liz made some changes, and one of them was they wanted to make a change at Radio 1. Pressure from the commercial lobby that Radio 1 was too commercial, and also pressure on frequencies. And the commercial sector at this point were very, very good, in fact, at lobbying the BBC. And the BBC was under severe pressure. And in fact, we had a strategy group formed while I was still at Radio 1, working out how we could defend Radio 1 and Radio 2 from the risk of being privatised. It was that serious. We really thought it was going to happen. And so at that point, I was also working very closely with the corporate strategy guys in the BBC. And I think that got the attention of Liz. In the meantime, Matthew Bannister came in as controller at Radio 1. I applied for the job, didn't get it. Matthew got the job. But Matthew kept me as managing editor, so I was Matthew's deputy. I think I persuaded Matthew away from some of his more crazy ideas, but Matthew still did some things I didn't really like. I still think he was too brutal with some of the DJs. These people were cleared out at a stroke. And, you know, the thing about radio is a DJ is your friend, he's your companion, and if you change too much too soon, listeners get upset by that, and Matthew changed too much too soon, and of course Radio 1 lost about 5 million listeners in about a year. So when Liz called me and said, we're creating this new job, head of strategy, and you're going to work with all the controllers and all the networks, and also there was the prospect of digital coming along. So I said, yes, I'll take the job, thank you very much. Again, didn't really know I could do it because you had to be a serious PowerPoint person to do this, and I wasn't really me, but I thought, well, I can learn this. I can learn this. And at the time, John Burt had set up these 10-year strategy groups. He'd come in from London Weekend Television as the Deputy Director General in charge of the news division, and then he became the Director General. What John wanted to do was he wanted to make sure the BBC was equipped for the digital age. So we're now talking, this is 94, 95, and so I had to do a 10-year plan for radio. I had to think, where are all these networks going to be? And commercial radio was still growing. I think at this point there are about 120 commercial stations. We were forecasting about 300 commercial stations. Commercial radio was eating into the BBC's audience. And some of the forecasters were saying the BBC might be down to 30% and commercial radio at 70%. Hasn't worked out that way, but that was the fear at the time. Radio 1 was repositioned, and Matthew did this work, to be much more focused on youth audiences, new music, British music, smaller audience. But the irony was that the political lobby believed that Radio 1 was more distinctive because it had lost lots of listeners. Now, actually, it lost lots of listeners because it wasn't as good as it was and had done some crappy things. Big tick in the box, Radio 1 must be more distinctive now. And commercial radio stopped complaining. So actually everyone was happy. So Radio 1 ticking the box, Radio 1 is fine. Radio 1 had been moved younger. And Radio 2 was really serving 55, 65 pluses. We had to move Radio 2 younger. And the controller had been appointed was a guy called Jim Moyer. And Leslie Douglas was there as head of planning and presentation. And so I worked very closely with Jim. And I wrote this strategy for Radio 2, which Jim really very generously adopted. And it was to start creating new windows for younger audiences, starting at weekends.
That sounded great.
Yeah.
And the whistle in the middle, hats off. What a play.
There were two big controversial hires, Steve Wright on Sunday mornings and Jonathan Ross on Saturday mornings. And Jim bought into this. And then we started working on the music and gradually refreshed everything on Radio 2. And of course, the rest is history. Jim took that on, and then Leslie subsequently took that on. But that was the origins of it. Radio 2 was actually, really was dying. I mean, it really was a very safe, middle-of-the-road network, and it was losing audience every single book. One of the problems was the breakfast show at Radio 2 had been all over the place. Terry Wogan had left and gone on to television. We had Derek Jameson do it. We had Brian Hayes do it. And it didn't really work. And so we thought, we need to bring back Terry Wogan. Wogan was coming towards the end of the Wogan talk show on TV, and we persuaded Wogan to come back. So that was the big thing. We'll put Wogan back on Radio 2 Breakfast. Jonathan Ross, Steve Wright, that's going to start revitalising Radio 2.
Do you know, I haven't been awake or up and about this early since God was a boy.
We did start getting a younger audience at the weekend, but the Wogan audiences didn't move. There was no increase for the first book or the second book. Or the third book. And at this point, remember, Liz saying, is this working? Have you done the right thing? You know, he's not increasing the audience at all. And then fourth book, we saw a slight uptick. And from then on, every book, Wogan added audience and added audience and added audience. And it was a runaway success. Radio 3 had a big problem in that Radio 3 listeners, and indeed Radio 4 listeners, preferred Classic FM. And what happened to the Today audience was when the Today audience finished at 9 o'clock, a lot of them actually wanted classical music. They'd all go to Classic FM, they wouldn't go to Radio 3. Because the reason was, on Radio 3 at 9 o'clock, it was Composer of the Week.
Time now on BBC Radio 3 for the final part of this week's Composer of the Week.
And it was always the difficult stuff. It was always the challenging music, the stuff you'd never heard before, by composers you'd never heard before. As they used to say at Radio Review Board, it's a difficult listen. Well, it was a bloody useless listen, actually. What we decided to do was to try and put on Radio 3 a slightly more inviting programme at 9 o'clock, and so we put Gambaccini on there doing a programme of more popular classics. And Gambo was a joy to work with, of course, and it was actually a really, really great show. The problem was it was too much for the most of the Radio 3 audience. It was too much like Classic FM. So we actually did get more Radio 4 listeners coming across, but we lost Radio 3 listeners because they said, A, he's an American. How can you have an American voice on? This is outrageous. And there was a real resistance to Paul's voice, which is ridiculous. And also they said, you know, it wasn't Radio 3. You know, that's not what Radio 3 is about. So we had to change that. Not Paul's fault, entirely my fault. And then the next part was inventing all the digital networks. And so looking at where the gaps were, and there's obviously a gap for the Asian network and another music network, which was going to be what became Radio 6 Music, BBC 6 Music. But it wasn't called that at the time. And I remember pitching this idea of what is now 6 Music to the BBC governors. And the problem, of course, with that is they didn't understand music. And so to argue there's a different segment that you can serve that's not Radio 1 and Radio 2. So I remember I worked with Johnny Walker, and Johnny Walker and I did this demo together of this station, of records that he and I had chosen. And we gave them the cassette. And when they got the cassette, they go, OK, now we get it.
This is Talk Radio UK.
And then one day, someone came knocking again, a headhunter, and said, would you like to run your own station? We know that you didn't get the job at Radio 1. Would you like to run Talk Radio? So Talk Radio was the second national commercial network that launched, 1053, 1089 AM. Talk Radio launched in 1995, and its first year was Shock Jocks, Caesar the Geezer and so on, and it had a horribly complicated shareholder structure, and the shareholders were arguing with each other, and its audience figures were absolutely appalling. There was a consolidation of ownership, and CLT bought it. So CLT had Channel 5 in the UK, they had Atlantic 252, and they bought out the other shareholders and got control. Brought in as chairman Travis Baxter, Travis said, would you like to run talk radio? And would you? Can you get it into profit and into decent-sized audience? I did think twice because this was clearly a problem station. But they were doubling my salary. And so off I went to talk radio. And I remember looking at the financials on the first week I was there. Costs of about 12 million, revenue of about a million. So clearly every week we were getting money from the shareholders just to pay the salaries. Its schedule was a shambles. And advertisers hated it because the tone of it was just so aggressive. The other problem was that the national stations had had these fixed bids to bid for the licenses. By the time talk radio came round, people started thinking national commercial radio might be successful. And so talk radio's annual figure to the Treasury was £4 million. So I had to find ways to cut costs without affecting on air. And so we made some hires that really started to transform the station.
There is a chance that this is because he went with a prostitute. I think the choice is a painful one, but I don't think that this will be a situation.
We had Anna Rabin, who was great, brought in Lorraine Kelly, brought in Peter Dilly, brought in Danny Baker. I was very lucky that Danny Baker was fired by Radio 5 Live for saying something on the air. And so I had Danny Baker in the 6:06 slot on talk radio the following week in exactly the same slot, doing exactly the same show. And I got nearly all the Radio 5 Live audience come across to me. The slot, I think, quadrupled in 1 week. I mean, it was amazing. Quick Danny Baker story. I do remember when Danny was doing the show. It was Saturday afternoon. And we had a security guy on the desk. And he reminded me, I said, Paul, we've got a problem. He said, there's guys in the studio and they brought crates of beer into the studio. What should I do? And I said, what are they doing? He said, they're drinking beer. I said, are the beers anywhere near the faders, the desk? He said, no, they're at the back of the studio. I said, that's fine. He said, there's this guy called Chris there who's being very argumentative and he wants to go and get hamburgers and things for them. Should I do it? And I said, what's his second name? He said, oh, I don't know. I'll go and find out. He said, it's Mr. Evans. I said, that's fine. Danny had Danny Kelly and Chris Evans in the studio and they were also on this phone-in. So, of course, I had an amazing piece of radio. It was one where the management had to basically, you know, clench your bum cheeks together, hope you weren't going to get in court the next day, hope they didn't put beer down the faders. But aside from all that, you had amazing radio. Brilliant. We did all of that and tightened up the sound and created a station sound. And I guess what we were aiming for was really sort of mid-market, sort of Daily Mail, Daily Express. So we weren't competing with Radio 4. You know, that really revived talk radio and got it to... It's a record audience, actually. We got to 3.6 million from, I think, 2.2 when I walked in. But we got to the point where the station now had value. CLT had bought it for a very nominal amount. The station was now valued at sort of 27, 30 million pounds. And so CLT decided to sell. It was acquired by a consortium which was a combination of Liberty Media and News Corporation with Kelvin McKenzie as the head of it. And I do remember having a lunch with Kelvin, where he told me how he wanted to run the station in future. Ignoring the expletives, because every other word was the F word, the summary of it was that Kelvin would take my job, I'd do all the hard work, and he'd take all the credit. And I thought, maybe this isn't quite for me. And that was really my sort of end of my 18 years of doing radio as a career. So I went off to Walt Disney, and Disney wanted me to run the Disney Channel, but do it a bit like a radio station. And so I introduced live programmes. The thing about Disney Channel was that all the programmes were 22 minutes, so you'd schedule 2 22-minute in an hour. So you had 8 minutes every half hour to fill. So I thought, why don't we put a presenter in a studio and let's have games and quizzes and phone-ins and do it live?
That radio station is Capital Disney, and we'd love to take this opportunity.
And I did actually, while I was at Disney, do one more radio thing, actually. I did a joint venture with David Mansfield, who was then the CEO of Capital Radio. And we introduced a station called Capital Disney. And the reason we did that was because Disney was not allowed, as an American company at that point, to own a radio station. You know, my radio love and heart was still there, even though I was working for Disney running TV. So I ended up running TV for Europe, and then they sent me off to LA, and then I became in charge of Disney Television globally from LA for the whole world, including the US. And then did a similar thing for NBC Universal, another American studio. We built a network called KidsCo with a joint venture with two studios, which we ran out to 98 countries. And then eventually, when Comcast acquired NBC Universal, they decided they didn't want to be in the kids' TV business, so they fired me as the chief executive, and off I went into the sunset, but with a cheque in my back pocket. And then since then, I've been doing digital consultancy for customers all over the world, content, animation, apps, and so on. And also, I'm the chairman of East London Radio, which is a community online station serving the East London boroughs. And they see me now as the sort of elder statesman. I'm wheeled out to talk to sponsors, and I chair the board meetings and, you know, encourage the volunteers. It's all volunteers. And there's some great shows on there. I mean, there's a grassroots football show, there's a business show, there's a live Saturday morning show. You know, I have that involvement, and that's a nice thing to be involved with. I guess my one regret is I didn't get to work at Capital. I wanted to work at Capital, and I did apply to work at Capital three times. I've got a pile of rejection letters from loads of people anyway. I mean, I applied to Radio 1. I remember, actually, I've got one rejection letter from a producer at Radio 1 that was quite a tough letter back to me, but then I ended up being his boss in the future, which is quite interesting. I was rejected by people high and low, including Capital three times. My most enjoyable time is probably being on the air, actually. You know, I still think that ability to be on the air, playing music and running that show and talking to listeners and just being on the air is the most brilliant thing. Probably getting to Radio 1 was the biggest break, and I'm so grateful for that. But also then going to the Walt Disney Company. I mean, you've never expected, you know, someone who started in hospital radio to end up running Disney Television from Burbank, from Los Angeles, from Hollywood. But I did. So, you know, that was great. I hired some people and been the wrong people. I think probably the biggest mistakes I've made in management have been not hiring the right people. And I think now I'd put more emphasis on recruitment. You know how it is, you know, someone goes and you think, I've got to hire and fill that gap and I've got a hole. And so you meet candidates, and what you do is you hire the best person from that bunch. But really, in your heart of hearts, you know that person's not quite good enough. So I think I've made a number of hiring gaffes, but you can't relive life, and I wouldn't want to. Maybe I'd like to go back and try one more time to get to Capital. Maybe meet one or two of my heroes I never met. A lot of those voices who I just idolized are still people I never met and just listen to on the air. And in a way, maybe it's better, because that way the image is not tainted by the real person. But I still wish there were one or two people I'd actually had the chance to shake the hand and say, I love what you do.